Nou, liever bij. Ja.
I can't write.
And our arguments are obviously quite stark from a historical point of view, and this relates to the fact that Provence, the institution establishment of Provence, is something that was that primarily black low-income workers fought for under the party government, and was also ensured that they had a measure of control in relation to the time frames, and that was obviously to take it out of the London rather than to invest it in funds that they did not trust. Further, our argument is that this is devoured wages. It's not money that belongs to anyone else but workers, so workers have the right to decide how that money is used and how they control it. In addition, and this is a call that's made by other organizations, we feel the need to be a broader discussion. Any retirement reform has to deal with the broader discussion around comprehensive social security, which also relates to the broader arguments on how we deal with the historical legacy of poverty and inequality. And then finally, we also want to look at the radical transformation of the retirement industry, which we feel that there's literally trillions of rand invested and with no control from workers as to how those things invested, and also in terms of the nature of investments that we think, for example, more ethical, or whether or not they should create jobs and those kinds of things. So that would be the context historically from where we come from. In relation to the revenue law amendment law itself, and specifically in relation to compulsory annuitization, we know that this law itself does not deal compulsory annuitization, and it relates to, it's preceded by the taxation laws amendment bills from the previous year, and particularly initiated in 2013. Now, up front, we want to indicate that LIMSA is opposed to compulsory annuitization, and obviously the emphasis on the compulsory aspect of it. And this is notwithstanding the fact that there has been some differentiation that's been built into the law. Firstly, the 246,000 rand threshold, in terms of which, above which, the law becomes applicable. Also, in terms of the exclusion of those who are 55 years and older, and exclusion of government fund contributions that are made prior to the law's operation. We feel that notwithstanding the fact that it does exclude all the contributions up until the operation of the law, that this actually fragments the ability of workers to actually engage in this issue, and also the other things that this actually discriminates against younger workers. And younger workers also have the right to make decisions in relation to their retirement savings. We understand that the main purpose of this bill is to postpone compulsory annuitization, as opposed to our call, which is to actually repeal it. We also understand that this bill does not postpone, which is something that we do welcome, which is the equalization of tax treatment of workers' contributions towards public funds. And I know that the argument from Treasury has been that they can't argue this politically. We feel that there's discrimination against the contributions of workers' contributors to public funds, because essentially they're paying double, even twice the amount of tax, even if they don't claim a tax credit at the point of making the monthly contribution to public funds. They will still be taxed fairly heavily if they make a withdrawal before retirement age. And in fact, as we understand, if they take a lump sum as opposed to annuitizing, there's additional tax implications as well. So it's not as if there aren't already other tax incentives that are put in against Provident Fund holders. On the question of postponed versus repeal, we think that there are some procedural issues that need to be raised. First, you know, we are uncertain as to what this means, because as we understand, compulsory annuitization is an act of law that's operational from the 1st of March. And to some extent, there will have to be some measures of compliance that will have to be put into place by the retirement fund industry, which also creates certain uncertainty. So obviously what we have is a situation where obviously we have non-compliance, condoned non-compliance, that would be effective retrospectively. We're also concerned that there has been very minimal consultation by Treasury of workers and trade unions, including through the NEDAC. We obviously believe that it should be beyond NEDAC as well, but there has to be consultation. These are worker monies. We're also particularly concerned that the discussions have been fragmented from the discussions on developing a policy for comprehensive social security framework, which we argue Treasury has been delaying for some time. Finally, somewhat different from other organizations, our concern also is that, and this relates to other measures in which the Church has put through through Parliament, is that because the compulsory annuitarian salvation is not a tax matter per se, it's not the imposition of taxes, it should not have been treated or put through proceedings under Section 77 and carried to the money bill. And we feel that that's actually opened up to constitutional challenges. I mean, this would be the first bill that has actually been tagged incorrectly and has been successfully challenged in the Constitutional Court. And on that basis, we are considering our legal options as to how we will proceed in terms of our main reforms legally as far as the 2013 laws that have been introduced. We also want to just deal with something which also underpins this law, which is the question of poor savings culture. And, you know, linked with these treasury arguments that, or they can say that we want to reduce reliance on the state of social assistance. And we think, yeah, we would also like to do that by checking decent work. And I think that would also, you know, issue tax revenues and have a disability there. But our argument is that, yes, there is poor savings there, but it's got nothing to do with culture at all. South Africa is not different from any other country globally with lower income earners. We actually have lower savings, and essentially because you'll find that fortunately households with lower income spend more on consumption. We also have a problem where you have the banking system and financial sector as a whole has marginalized lower income workers. Not too recently, we had a failed attempt as far as domestic workers was to actually establish a special retirement fund model for domestic workers, and obviously that would have been that made the basis for other low-income workers, which shows you that the retirement fund industry and financial sector is not friendly to low-income workers and also undermines the issue of savings. And then finally, I think this is an argument we're all familiar with. There are stock sales and example stock sales and bailing societies that actually reflect that low-income workers and households actually do reflect the culture of savings, but have had to find all alternative ways to deal with this because of the of a financial system and the economic system that you forces them out. For the next slide that I want to deal with, I actually handed out a larger copy because I think the one in the pack is actually not legible. But I think it's important for us to actually contextualize what we're dealing with, because I think if we look at pension on assets, it actually speaks to how generally South Africa is the most unequal country in the world. It also speaks to how it actually relates to pension fund assets. If you look at the tables that it has, and these are not NUPA tables, these are from the OECD data. The first table just details pension fund assets as a percentage of GDP for OECD countries. And the second one has a percentage of pension fund assets in relation to GDP for non-OECD. So South Africa is reflected in the second group. If you look at the OECD group, it's quite important. You find that South Africa would probably find itself somewhere just below the United Kingdom. In fact, it's not just relatively large, it's massively large. It would fall into, you know, the kind of relatively average saving that would be to a very wealthy industrialized country. It is the largest, it's in funds relative to GDP, actually the largest among OECD countries, and you'll find there's a big gap between themselves and the bulk of the developing countries on that list as well. When you take that particular fact and say we can see that they use huge assets, but also then weigh it up against the fact that yes, actually, the majority of people in this country will not be covered either adequately or enough by pension funds, then you can see that there is a recession or trajectory of a huge inequality. Our concern and also the basic question of what we need to do with conflict of social security. It's not so much only about workers just having control and being able to serve their rights around retirement funds. It's that the need for broader comprehensive social security discussion to link up with retirement is to understand how we can actually equalize access and production for retirement, and also before retirement, ending retirement, and in the way that provides a sustainable decent income. And that discussion has been had, and we have to, and it cannot be held in a fragmented way. The other issue that also raises also in terms of socioeconomic data is that you'll find that if you look at the current dynamic in terms of our apartheid labor market, we, as I mentioned before, we're just unable to push workers to save at the level that we would prefer, so to be able to thriving with a sustainable income and climate. So essentially, the economic system is what actually drives them out of the system. And we also note that, you know, in spite of arguments pushed by, for example, the World Bank, the Treasury, the Free Market Foundation, globally and locally, you will see that trends reflect that labor's share of income, national income, is on the decline and has been in decline for a long time. And this goes, you know, as opposed to the arguments that, it's an ideologically driven argument, that wages constitute a major cost driver in the economy. In fact, we find that that data is questionable, and also data has been developed in other industrialized countries where they have fuller employment and better quality of employment as well. In fact, in a country where there's a high degree of informal employment and where you have very little coverage of a collective bargaining, it just doesn't, there's no relationship as wages being a cost driver. And so we also have the contradiction in that argument where you have Treasury trying to push policies that drive down wages, but at the same time expecting workers to save more. Because our argument, you know, if you save more, you have to earn more. And we have to deal with the outside part of wage up. The other contradiction, and this relates to and this is a broader discussion on the reforms that are required in relation to the finance and industry, and also more generally in relation to finance capital, is that there's already massive data now being, as South Africa, reflecting being one of the leading countries in terms of your illegal and as well as legal but controlled capital flights and financial flows. So on the one hand, you have Treasury that has lifted financial regulations to enable that to happen. And on the other hand, you have a system where they're trying to change a system where it actually locks workers' funds into retirement funds in a way that they are unable to access it as lump sums. Moving on to the question of comprehensive social security, I think for us it's actually important to note that upfront, MOSA is actually concerned about the interests of workers both during, before and after retirement, and we do not feel that there's that one is more important than the other. The boundary that you find that most workers find themselves is that retirement funds are now being used to plug gaps in the comprehensive social security net and require to fulfill other gaps that are not even related to retirement. But if you're based with retrenchment, you have no choice but to decide I'm going to save for later but start now. And that is a very difficult choice for them to make. The other issue is that the annuitization, which is not being, you know, which is not being raised directly, but which is pushed for implicitly and which is incorrect, is that annuitization from our calculations will not provide a decent income. So often you'll find that workers want to withdraw the lump sum, not so that they would spend it in a spendthrift way, but in order to look at ways of alternative income generation, which they can only do using a lump sum amount. So accordingly, yeah, we would argue for there being a more holistic and redistributive way of approaching the process. We'd also want to look at how we deal with those workers who are probably not in the foreseeable future going to be able to contribute to the retirement funds industry in the same way as workers in a better position, for example, like domestic workers and seasonal workers. We need to deal with how we can provide them with a decent income. Okay. In conclusion, I hope that it's been clear that we are basically both procedure and extent of concern. We are maintaining our argument that in this process, that the committee should rather repeal those problems rather than postpone them. And we maintain that call. We will also be pursuing our call through other processes. We currently have a Section 37 process before NEDAC, which enables us, if we complete the process, to go on project action, and we will also assess thereafter our legal options as well, whether or not we challenge the compulsory annuitization on a constitutional basis.
Okay, Christian Bevis.
To adjust the point of clarity from the number. I just want to find out if she is aware whether the kind of saving culture that she is talking about is largely corrupted. And people are generally saving only to spend that money on Chinese food end of the year. And I'm not sure if that aspect has been taken into account. And secondly, I also wanted you to probably speak into issues of, you know, somehow I'm not sure if your first, it's a slide. I'm not sure if your slide today is not contradicting itself. You know, the one that is entitled The Myth of a Poor Savings Culture. I'm not sure if you are not contradicting yourself, because on one hand, you are talking about poor level savings, not cultural. And you go further into saying it reflects the global trend of lower household income, explain greater proportion of income on consumption than saving. I'm not sure if you are not contradicting yourself there. Maybe you will clarify that to me. And the other issue that I think maybe you may tell us to address is because I actually do visit light voices. I generally sympathize with the light of voices. But on the other hand, the concern that I have is that if we keep on discouraging workers from, you know, maybe if we keep on discouraging them from really getting into this space where they really save for the future and not just for something that is instant, because I know that generally, either the savings that we have are savings around funeral, and my view is that I don't think that is a good kind of savings. Yes, we want to bury our relatives with honor and part of you, but what benefits does it bring to those that remain behind in terms of improving their quality of life? Now, that aspect I do have a challenge with. The other issue that I also wanted you to speak on is that in Nomsa's view, how competitive is our labor market in South Africa compared, not just, I'm not talking about the world, I'm talking about the continent as such. And I'll tell you why I'm asking you that question. I happen to have met somebody, a guy from Japan, and they were talking about, you know, opening another plant somewhere in Africa, where I cannot mention. And part of the reason why they were worried about South Africa was that their own experience with South Africa is that if you invest in South Africa, you will find that workers are demanding higher wages, which is fine, but that is not matched with productivity, and that creates uncompetitive labor environment. Now, I want to know, Ubuti, how are we addressing those issues? Because if we keep on denying that reality that is out there, we're going to end up with workers that think, you know, it's good to not save. And I'll tell you, my view is that to save, you have to be taught. Somehow, sometimes you have to, it's got some time. It's got to be imposed on you. I'm talking from my own experience, like from my mother, who would be imposing that to me, to say, you've got to say, you're not going to be getting this, you know. And the reality is that we've got to start confronting that. I am saying that because it's largely the black African working class that is affected by this. And if we keep on pushing the goalposts, I'm not sure where we are heading to. But I would welcome your comments. Maybe you have a reasonable explanation for that. I don't know. But these are issues that kind of trouble me all the time. Thank you.
Pinky, for you.
Thank you, Chief. Chairperson, mine is it's a general comment, and I think Treasury and Nomsa and or Kofat maybe can be able to assist me in this situation. And it's a very practical one. If you look at the intention of this act on monetization, and Momo speaking on the question. The public service in terms of the sex is not necessarily affected. Because currently as we speak, this has been what has been happening in the public service. And I can tell you, she has seated here, a teacher who took pension 10 years ago still is able to survive through the system of government on how to access monthly his or her own pension. Now, and I can also share my own experience, and this is what I want to challenge Nusa on. That 10 years ago, Western Deep Levels, as an example, my uncle was working there. They were laid off, they were given their money, and today he's queuing at social development, precisely because there's no means to survive. Now my issue is that, yes, there may be challenges on, and especially on the Provident Fund constituency. What is it that they are challenged? What is it that can be done to assist in this regard? But the trend is, I'm not getting it from Nusa to say we can proudly stand on top of this roof and say all our Provident Fund people who took their money 10 years ago are proudly surviving even today, and they are not a burden to the state. Have we done that survey as NUMSA, as COSATU, and all other, because the majority of your constituency are Provident Fund people. Because we should not be short-sighted when we deal with this thing. We must look at the reality. I'm sitting with my uncle, he's a burden on me, and he's a burden on the state, yet he had an opportunity to use that money sparingly and make himself survive. Now the challenge is, if we don't look into these things going forward, we are also going to say to government, there must be a legislation that also says, if you have been a government employee and you ate all your money, you used it up, you can't come back and queue for social development. Because we can't have, somewhere the bus must stop. Somewhere the bus must stop. I mean, this tab that we are opening, it can't be open forever and ever. I mean, so let's be realistic and find each other and be practical. Where are the people who were laid off, who were given those pensions, are they still surviving today with that money? I can tell you to be 1%, it is still there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And may I start off by saying, Chairperson, I noted when you actually introduced
Prakashi,
by stating that, you know, she was from this place and that has moved to that baby. You know, Chairperson, the fun of it is that, you know, if your child has turned against you, it becomes quite low. But if the child has turned against you, for a reason, I think you need to look at it, but you can always call the child to the side and there are other methods of the child. So Prakashi, do talk to your mothers and fathers every once in a while. That was the feeling that the child has been interested in that way. Secondly, Jefferson, on the culture of sales, which was addressed, I think Jefferson, we need to be realistic and say that yes, the culture of sales is a culture that's got to be educated into all our people. But I must say that from the African side, especially black people or black like me people, we always had these domestic workers, our mothers were domestic workers, we had all these top fells. That is how many of us were educated. I think even my brother just sitting across me there, he knows what I'm talking about. When it comes to being educated, our mothers were involved in top fells. During that time, even the banks were not even willing to even give our mothers an MBA so that they could save. so that they could put their money there. So the money were mostly put in trunks under the bed and everywhere else, but they knew our mothers that they needed to educate their children and do whatever. So it means that the culture had already started because many, many, many black people are educated through those money, which were put under beds, under those little trunks, with the little key and everything else. And everybody knew that underneath that bed, with that trunk, there is money, and that money is kept there because it cannot be taken anywhere else. Yes, we definitely do encourage this culture of savings. This is nothing new to us as a black people. And then later churches realized that they missed out on the greatest potential ever in South Africa, and that was when they started bringing in the stoppers, opening up banking books and doing everything else. So it's not really something that is new. Many of us were educated through that. But then through NUMSA, and that is the I'm sorry to use this word, but that's the only word I can think about. That is a child that has turned away from the mother body. From your slide, this postponement that has appeared, like I'm telling you, we're doing it for your own reasons, you know why you did it. It's quite important for one to realize that there are bodies or structures where you need to take this matter to, like the leg, like all the other bodies. We would be interested as a committee to hear or to get an input on the type of finer details of proposals. We do note some of them which are noted here, where you'd be taking them to NetLeg and everywhere else, but we'd like you to take the interest of the workers at heart as you take the matters forward. There's a matter here of the absence of the comprehensive social security. When one looks at the comprehensive social security, it means that we need to take into consideration some of the facts or some of the points which were brought about by Honorable Pinky here. We do have many of our people who were given their pensions that it was 10, very, very small amounts, which one could not even live with for 3 months. And they were expected to go on living with that for as long as they lived. Some actually died because they were so poverty-stricken and they couldn't do anything. What type of proposal now that you are NUMSA, away from the other structure, will you take forward to ensure that the actual interest of the country is at heart? So that our people, because it's years and years we've been negotiating with NEDLEC and everything else whilst we're still in the other structure, but then one would say to you, now that you are the other structure, now that you're NUMSA, how are you going to do this differently? Because you've done it for so many years and it hasn't really worked. We've had many people leaving your mining sectors and everything else who have been very good and loyal in their deductions every month to themselves. But once they leave and they go home, they become poverty stricken. In the end, they spend that money, as Honorable Pinky has stated, then they become poverty stricken and then they end up in those societies and then they need some money for living. How are you actually going to make it different? Because you knew about it many years back. And lastly, chapter 6, the very last line which NUMSA spoke about is that the very last point here is that NUMSA will pursue this call by lobbying parliament. I think that's what they are doing with ourselves and through other processes that we may lack. And then I think you also stated, madam, that you'd also be going to the streets and doing everything else. How is that going to be done in such a way that it does not affect the economy of the country, especially going to the streets, especially the much more, you know, fighting and going out into the streets and all that? Because right now, we need to structure everything that we do in such a way that we do not hurt the economy of the country, because once we hurt the economy of the country, it has that effect of hurting each and every other person. Thank you.
Okay, very quickly, one is, are you saying no to compulsory annuitization, but you find if workers choose to annuitize, do you want workers to have the option? Or are you saying no, in principle, no side of annuitization altogether? Secondly, whatever your views on annuitization, surely as I say, Julian, let me say again, you're also interested in the long-term interest of workers. Now, not every worker is so hard-pressed that they need to take the higher lump sum. And even those who earn too little and are too over-indebted need to have, in fact, more of them than middle-class backpacks like me. There is a stress to save. Because, you know, it's interesting. The argument on the one hand is, if you have very little, you can't save. It is also perhaps true to say, it's the fact that because you have little that you have to save as little as it is. It's also about what values you think. It's a transfer of a culture. You know, if you look at your own background or mine for that matter, there may be all sorts of criticisms about the role of unions in the economy of KKN and so on. Some of it is legitimate. But there also has to be a greater sense that there's a culture of freedom. In this community, we can't explain. I'm a sociologist. I did study all these things 25 years ago when I was teaching at a university. But why certain communities are more like Lebanese in West Africa, Indians in Fiji and South Africa, and elsewhere in Africa, East Africa. There are some communities that actually have a greater, it's linked to patterns of industrialization, but it's not biological. But it is culture. So if you look at Chinese people, so their capacity to say, they are cultural things. And I think what members are hinting at is even the worker in Lumsa is not earning a big salary, needs to save one thing. It's a saving culture. So his 7-year-old is a 7-year-old boy in school, acquires that. It's not something you can, like, sort of wait for workers to have huge salaries or for socialism to come in, okay. It's something you need to encourage now. Even saving, if the child is given 5 cents to go and spend in school and save 0.5 cent, doesn't matter the 0.5 cent, tomorrow the child, and of course he says her mother puts a lot of pressure. I'm thinking about myself also. It's for my mother actually. My mother says, I'll give you 2 cents, but you'll never spend the whole 2 cents. So there's nothing biological about me saving more. It's cultural, it's sociological, it's social, it's structural actually. So what I'm saying in short is, no matter what your views are, I think all trade unions need to encourage a sense of saving in the interest of the working class itself. The other point I want to raise with you is, look, you know, the trade union insists on this, that if you forego annuitization and harmonization of the pension and provident fund component of retirement, you're not going to get a tax reduction for workers, right? So presumably you're fine to formulate that. It's not going to happen. You see, the first side of the coin, they argue, I'm not taking it for the question. I mean, you look at these things also in a more technical way. But you see, the argument also is that there are a lot of people who are using the loophole at the moment, sadly, earning good salaries, they can explain to you, who actually enter into provident funds and avoid certain type of obligations. So in other words, if we leave it as they are and not have annuitization, then what you're going to have is certain people are, and this is your clock anyway, if you like, they're going to actually benefit enormously, right? I mean, Momo and others explained it, they can do some better. Now you see, this is interesting. You're saying that South Africa's saving is not substantially different from other low-income countries, but I thought, along with experts in the newspapers, what I mean in business, which are very mad, by the way, I need to correct that thing. I did say it was saying yesterday. But it was saying irritation when people are being very sympathetic to the GDP people. And I said, how? Who are these people? They're not doing this because they changed their heart and they're suddenly patriotic and they love this country. So they're doing it because, frankly, they're in trouble. Comes next year. And then I didn't expect that of all the things, you never even comment on anything useful to say. Now it becomes an issue. I said they're all, I did say that. Now I have to go and correct that because it's going to frighten people. We should all be in jail. So can I put that on record? This is okay. We should ban the public. I was going to ban it. But I didn't need to say it like that. What do I think personally? The committee feels that we must encourage these people, errant as they be. That's the most I will say, errant as they be, to bring their money back. It's our money. It's the country's money. So I need to correct that somehow. Leave that aside for now. What I'm saying is that until now, the business day commentators and others, business reporters, were saying there were no savings,
culture by the sense of comparable countries. In a willing country, loving country. So I didn't news to me. I don't expect you to get interesting responses. On your thing about Cajun, look, I'm no expert, but I've been around a long time. I think you're on very weak ground. Very weak. But hey, it's your right to go to the United Nations, wherever you want to go. International Labour Organization, WTO, David Spring, all of that this morning. You know, going to Al Jazeera to complain that something going on across the air. So. Now, the thing is, what I'm saying, Prakash, is I think, as Jacob, will you reply? You're the advocate on our side, and then the advocate, Mormon, will also reply on the tagging issue. We did discuss yesterday, but now we would like to share with you what he was yesterday. The other things I'll leave. I also want to suggest, look, this is my own view. I'm not saying the majority will agree with it, but I have gone on record, and I thought we more or less we've been to some or other extent, that, you see, there are people who say, the reason we don't like this privatization is because it's rescuing the government from its welfare responsibility to the poor and disadvantaged. That actually, you know what, it's this old Trevor Manuel story about, we can't continue to be a nanny state, right? So, there are times when I know some of the unions feel, ah, you see, the government now wants to reduce the welfare aspect of the thing. So, you know, they want our workers to pay the burden on us instead of introducing higher taxes. Now, I don't know whether Treasury, to what extent Treasury thinks that, but it's a highly credible argument to say, you know what, the kick must continue in a society of such huge inequalities and high unemployment to play its part. All of us, I would imagine, some or other degree, know it's unsustainable. With 0.9% growth rate projected for this year, with investment, you know, trickling out, the prospect of the state being able to provide is limited. But on the other hand, I don't think one should argue, that's my view, that, you know, we must have an privatization primarily because the state must be rescued from its responsibility, not as unsustainable as it looked at. So I would prefer that you see the Congress don't necessarily agree with that, but we still hold the view that some form of any of the region is something that in the longer term needs to work at. See, on the issue of over-indebtedness and so on, in our first report we said it, I think we said we're excruciatingly aware of strongly people feel about how emotional they are. Even people on pension funds, teachers, literate people, with master's degrees and postgraduate diplomas in teaching. Let me tell you, I was in the city late this weekend. This is a teacher, you know him. Killing me a heart. Then I tell you, you're not affected at all. You're not affected. So the other two say, but you know, how? For the next 45 minutes, I'm going to go, it's hot, and I'm on the road for the whole day, and I sat there for the extra 45 minutes doing this job, you're so impressive. They were shocked. Those people are saying to me, but you know, I thought I'm also affected. Sorry? So what I'm saying is, you know what? I mean, you know what, you can have your views, but hey, I'm not convinced by a lot of things you say. Really, Prakashni. We understand. You represent the working class directly, Kusat Gaz, but hey, you know, all of us know how strongly people feel about it. But it's really, we've got to handle this thing in a measured way. And you know what? You'll go on a strike whatever way you want. Not naive. Also, no, we're not naive. It's not just about the issues or the merits or the demerits of the bill before us. It's about you flexing your political muscle. You want to form a new federation. You've got to outplay them and they try to flex their muscle too. You've got to, hey, she doesn't acknowledge I'm a communist. But you know what? We are being made here as footballs between all of you, fighting for membership. But on the longer term, all sides must think about it. What is in the objective long-term interest of the workers? In some form or another, Prakash, even if Ivan Zuma is president tomorrow, you think you guys are going to be able to say, oh, no, you know what? The state will deliver. You will have to find some compromises between the positions you hold and the positions Treasury holds. And we are urging Kosatu to grudgingly
I mean, dragging them by the scruff and saying, strike a deal, the in between. Right? So they too, you see, the more militant you are, the more militant they are. And the more militant they are, the more militant you have to be. So this is a fight for membership thing, at all costs. And you have to flex your muscle, you launch your new federation in the first place. Right? You really have to outdo them, you're battling with full and canning on your side, other units are not coming, you need to seem to be more militant. So it can be suggested that, hey, is it about the specific merits of this bill, or is it about ensuring that you exceed the membership and the political weight of Fasalsu? So, you don't have to answer those questions, but you brought this upon yourself. Right. How about you, Advocate Jacob, before we allow Advocate Mormon to respond?
Thank you, Chairperson. For me, there's two ways we looked at the argument. And the first way is, when the bill comes to our office, we advise the joint government mechanism out. If we look at the court case that has been given to us, not on Section 77, but on 75 and 76, both these are the procedures in the Constitution. Constitutional Court has made it very clear. If you look at the purpose and effect of the legislation to an extent that you know, what you're actually looking at, what's the impact of this legislation? What's the real impact it's going to have when you're doing study or classification? As I said, we have an Article 77 in the courts. When you look at this book, it changes the definitions, first and foremost, in the tax, Income Tax Act, so that you get an extension or a delay of an annuitization of problem funds. Secondly, it amends certain sections in the Taxation Laws Amendment Act of 2015. But see, when I look at that, I've just gone through it again. When I look at the effect of those laws, it affects the way we calculate what can be deducted from tax and how we determine that. So therefore, when I wrote the classification to the JTM, I advised that it's a 77 bill. The other way that one can approach this question is just to simply ask, would it be okay for this committee to introduce a bill like this in terms of the Constitution? And if one says yes, then it can't be a money.
Mm.
Because the money bill can only be introduced by a Minister of Finance.
Mm.
And there again, I don't think it's the purpose of the Constitution to say that Parliament can introduce legislation like that, that will have a fiscal impact. Or even if a financial impact, even if it's not so big as fiscal. I think that, for me, that both pointed out at the 77 book. It's not a, it can be a highly technical exercise, not supposed to be a highly technical exercise, according to what courts have said, or certain comparative jurisdictions we looked at through the years. And as you said, sir, this is not the first time we struggled with this, we've worked on this through the years, through the 15 years I've been in Parliament. And the courts have said that it's sometimes a very grey area, but you have to look at the impact of this. Thanks, sir.
But can I just ask you, do you think it's also relevant to say that actually the bill, you remember for Kashi, I think he was still on, I think he was in 2013 it was passed, right? So it's actually an amendment to a fiction, to 76 taking bill, right? Secondly, you're also extending tax provisions here to those who are on provident funds, who until now have been excluded from a tax deduction. So again, it's a money bill in Section 77. So we are a bit confused actually on why we're holding to that argument, which is your right. But Momo, you want to reply to anything before we hand over to Prakash? But before you do, let's have you in with you.
Sure, before Momo and the presenter respond, there's one thing that I've identified in the letter to the chairperson, also as she was presenting, that one of the major of serious concern that they are having is lack of consultation. I think when we were addressing in the public hearing last week and several times, we've been talking about the level of consultation, and this is what is going to the public. What is the understanding of NUMTA in as far as consultation is concerned? And I think Treasurer can also clarify that. Because the public is getting an information or is informed that the Treasury of Government is not consulting us, and literally they are deciding on the lead. But we need to clarify that, and what do they understand about consultation? Because consultation, you can agree and not agree, but you've been consulted, there's an engagement. So Treasurer can also assist in terms of
what I
mean.
Yeah. What we did is, we could send you a copy of the thing. We dealt with outside of Parliament. We don't know what we did, just actually. What more would we have done apart from the pretense? But on the issue of Treasury consulting, they came with a list of meetings in hand, in that lab primarily. And we said, okay, you have these meetings. So we can see you had meetings, but as for the quality of the meetings, no. did the negotiations take place in a meaningful way? We can't comment on it, we weren't there. Now, as I understand it correctly, we have to remember, if I understand it correctly, you're not part of NEDLAC, right? Because NEDLAC only includes trade union federations. So, the treaty has to engage with you outside the NEDLAC process. we should separate two things. What does Parliament do that is so wrong? We just do it quite normally because we have public, as you know, I don't know if you know this committee, but it's like the committee is united from decrees to which I said we have public consultation called a long vote and a vote. So, I don't know what more we could have done, but as far as the executive goes, Treasury, we have alerted them to this. They need to consult more meaningfully, not just nominally. And they've committed themselves to doing so. In fact, they've been a bit shaken, I think, what's happened over this bill, and they've learned lessons. So, on consultation, I agree with you completely. And that's what we're supposed to do. Richard, that over to you at the moment. We're going to move on, please.
Yeah, Chair. Basically, yeah. I think on the tagging, Advocate Jenkins dealt with the issues. But, in fact, if NUMSA does open this up, like you said, we're not preventing people from annuitizing or not annuitizing. If there's no tax deduction, but there's a tax deduction, then it needs to be in a textbook. Just like when you have the auto plan, the incentive,
yeah,
the employment tax, whatever incentive, of which NUMSA is a big beneficiary, I would like to see whether they use the same arguments when it comes to those issues as well. I think with regard to the second point, we've never argued. NUMSA likes to paint people in a corner. If you argue like that, that's fine. But certainly, we never argued that annuitization must be done to prevent people from coming to the state. Obviously, the issue is this. What the state gives you is very little. As a worker, you earn. If you are only going to be reliant on what the state gives you, it's going to be very little. It's what's called replacement income. In fact, if you look at our issue last year, when we said we are looking at removing the means test for the old age grant, or at least for those who are annuitized, so you don't have a perverse incentive, that those who say don't qualify for the old age grant, we actually want to extend it, because coverage is very high already, but to remove the perverse incentives in the system. Let me say that, if you look at the Metro Workers Fund, MUFSA, it's one of the best funds we probably have in the country. They have both pension and poverty. And in fact, what you find is that, I forget the exact ratio, but 70% of their members are in provident funds, say 50% in pension funds. But then you find the assets are completely the other way. 70% of the assets are with pension funds, but 50% say with those in provident funds. And that's precisely because those who are there in bigger numbers actually cash out. So even the grants that are provided, you must take that into account, that people have cashed out. And here's a big issue that we do want to know, is are they saying they are against annuitization, they are against also all forms of preservation, although the two are preservation before time. I think that's a big issue, and leadership is needed. Certainly, we've had a case, and NUMSA reps have argued that they don't want annuitization and we should follow the UK Conservative government. Now, we're certainly not new conservatives, so we won't want to follow that kind of approach, but I find it interesting that those sorts of arguments have been...
Will the Financial Times article move?
Yes, I will circulate it now. I'll get them to circulate that. Thanks for reminding me. I'm getting forgetful.
Oh, my God.
I think this, the last point I would like to make is we'd like to engage with NUMSA, and I think part of the problem, of course, is that now that they're not part of NEDLAC, I've been talking to the office of Mr. Jim, and for the last 3 weeks we can't get a date. We said we'll be there any time to engage on these issues, and we'd like to continue this because we think these issues are important, and it's important that one just doesn't take an ideological position when it really affects people on the ground. And we think that just given the base that they have with funds like MUFSA and so on, it would be a tragedy if people are given the wrong advice. I think it's important that we converge on these issues and take into account their concerns. And going forward, how can they also come into any consultation process?
Good. Okay, Bakashi, you're the time. Great. You have 10 minutes. Fine.
I'll just fire for the good health.
So yeah, you've been extremely wise. That's why I say you put down meetings. There's no anxiety, right? So you don't be suspicious of her. The world has changed. You're suspicious of the ANC, but you're not suspicious of the IFP. How the world has changed.
Chairman, the interesting word used by Prakashi is prodigal. I understood prodigal. That means someone who's already returned.
I think, look, I'm just going to deal with some, I probably won't deal with them exactly in order. On the question of whether it's a political exercise, I just want to state very clearly, we are the ones who actually represent the majority of the workers who are affected by this. And the mandate, it comes with that mandate. So, CASU, unfortunately, is primarily a public service union right now. And their mandate is somewhat shaky. On the group of anti-privatization and intervention, there is no fundamental opposition to it at all. It's a compulsory nature of it. And you won't find anything anywhere that says we post anti-privatization as a matter of principle of preservation. There are workers who may choose to preserve and leave it there. So let's just put that out of the thing. And on the question of ideological positions, we would argue that on both sides, the ideological position of Treasury is following an ideological path, not based necessarily on statistics and data. On the question of tagging, and obviously this is a technical argument, we are differentiating between the tax credit portion and the annualization compulsory taxation part. As far as tax credits are concerned, we would agree that goes into the money vault. Compulsory annualization, which simply says you can't take after full lump sum, but you have to annualize two-thirds in our taxation issue. And we even looked at the definitions in terms of the Section 77 Constitution, and that's why we argue, for example, you've had to split bills like around UIS, around skills development, and if you had to come back and acquire the compensation occupational injuries, we would have to split that bill as well. So there is a big technical argument to be made, and we feel that we've taken legal advice on this, so it's not just myself arguing this, we've taken legal advice that you support the prefecture as a case of this. And obviously this is a technical issue, and you know, we've had a different tagging issue. It was the Camille Lambert Act, which was declared unconstitutional in terms of the inquiry tag. So we think that this is a case we made. On the question of whether or not poor savings is a culture, I don't think I contradict myself, but I think maybe I expressed it incorrectly or not so well in the slide. We are saying that people are not saving because they just don't have a culture of saving. You know, they don't know. It's just the system prevents them. And I understand the sociological arguments, but I think built into the sociology is certain economic, historical things that go with it. You know, I come from a background, just speaking personally, some are working class background, historically. But I have to say that my background is different from the vast majority of African working class people. So some parts of those things actually either benefited us to be able to enable us to participate more formally, I would think, in the banking system than for the average working class African person in the country. On the question of whether or not we should be talking about saving and what Noosa's role is, and I think this is where we did make an argument that we are concerned about what happens to a worker both before and after retirement. So we're not, as annualization, as a preservation, we're not opposed to saving. In fact, reality is that as far as resources are concerned, we agree. There is a finite resource. We obviously want to look through a comprehensive social security model and alternative mechanism of financing that, but we understand that not everybody can just spend. But the argument is that workers are not spending because they are being lavish with their money. And I understand the anecdotal example given about a person who retired 10 years ago and was exhausted with the problem. But we've got anecdotal stuff where people were forced to dig into their province on lump sum because they had no choice. It was either you put food on the table or you save for a time that you'll never reach. So there is that challenge, and that's where we argue that this debate becomes very difficult to be had because the retirement fund is being used to plug a debt that shouldn't be plugged, which is what we do in the current finances, and we need to deal with that. And we would argue that the vast majority, I mean, look, there would be individuals who, I would think, that, like in an individual poor or wealthy, it would be individuals for each country, but we think the vast majority of people who look at Chen actually reflect that distinction in terms of being shut out of the system, not having an access. On the question of...
Sorry. No, I just wanted to know, is the assumption, I just want to find out, is an assumption that you can make here is, if you say there is a high probability that you will not reach your retirement age, I'm just wanting to be clear on that one, because that's what you said.
No. No, we're saying
it's about you. Rather than for the retirement, you may even another bridge.
I'm trying to express myself. Okay. What I'm saying is that you're forced to use your savings for now, which is not your savings. The savings, your problem on pension or retirement, you're pensioning in for retirement age.
Mm.
But you're forced to now make a difficult choice of using it at a time when you're not retired.
Yeah.
But you change. Or you're facing some other kind of, or you short time those kinds of things, so you find that people may dip into it. And we really should be creating a system where savings are encouraged. There's no way will you find an opposition to savings. In fact, looking to all our collective bargaining would be how we can increase our rights in terms of problem funds. That's got nothing to do with us not wanting to save. There's no fundamental objection to saving. In fact, the reality is that by saving and contributing in terms of, you know, relative to, and I can't remember the best understand this about each according to meeting according to ability, is that we need to redistribute resources. We can't all be spending. So resources have to be built up and have to come from somewhere. There's no fundamental objection to saving.
But you must not be any kind of question.
We've not said that. We said that it can't be compulsory.
People can have an option.
People don't have the option.
They can't be forced to any of that, but
yeah.
They want to any of that.
Well, I think we would argue, obviously, that based on the different economic system, more people would choose that an option than family. In the extended family culture, people, and I think too much spoken about that, I thought, so people understand what happens to people in retirement. It's not something that's removed from reality. I mean, there's a concept called black tax. You know, in terms of how extended families have to bear the burden of what we would argue is a social economic phenomenon that we've inherited. I want to answer one question because
okay.
There was one question that was, which I don't think was relevant, but I think actually what we need to deal with, because I think it deals with a myth, and I think also the media, and, you know, you can also take responsibility, I can also take a stand as well. A lot of this gets put out about productivity. Now, also, you know, and maybe change your opinion to take respect to those things as well. For years, we've had incorrect data that's been put out about labor productivity. In fact, labor productivity since the end of the budget has always been increasing. And in fact, there was 1 year reserve that put out data that actually excluded, I think it was the financial sector, and then it went to the next year to put it, and actually it reflected it as a decline, but incorrect results. And for years, they've been getting smith. As far as concerns in relation to higher wages and in terms of our labor legislation, those are based on business surveys, it's based on employee surveys. Now, how is it that a survey that has the opinion of the employer is seen as empirical, whereas if I, representing my member, saying that those wages are too low and exploitative, it's not seen as empirical, it's seen as being biased. We've got two parties in the same relationship. I have asked journalists who've asked me the same question, if our labour market is not inflexible, I've asked them to explain what they mean to the English fund. They've not been able to. And then I've taken them to the question and said, well, actually, a lot of people talk about custom. The journalists can explain which position it is. It's also been proven that the IMF and World Bank, for example, has used incorrect data, huge institutions, and we believe that's ideologically driven as well. They've used costings in terms of dismissals that have got nothing to do with the actual costing in terms of retrenchment. And in fact, they will use the cost of retrenchment, which we know is dismissal based on economic operations, to get hiring and firing versus misconduct, which is very different pictures. So, yeah, we are struggling under the burden of a poor image that has been put out in the media, not factually driven. But, yeah, that is something that obviously is our responsibility to shift. But yeah, we would argue that this is more of a media-driven And although, you know, they are parties within government, also Heather Smith as well, in terms of productivity, and it's even in the latest budget review around public servicing, there's no way that we understand the same major productivity data. So, yeah.
Wow. Thanks, Prakashini. Makoti, you quoted something I'd long forgotten about. I just remembered now. I'm feeling very hurt at the moment. I just warned my mother. You see, I remember about how old I was. It must have been 6 or something. And she said to me, I saw a belt, you know, in one of these outfitters in Church Street, right, in the window. So she said, all right, save money, and you can buy this belt. It was 11 cents. So I spent like over a year, my first few listening as well, because you prompted this whole deep thing about unconscious. Yeah. So listen, it's very painful. So I saved the 11 cents. So I said, Mom, I'm going to buy this thing for one of these schools. She said, no, give the 11 cents. She said, we're putting the money for it. Well, I was so upset, you know. I just forgot, because I said, where does, what was this called? And she, this thing, braces. And she said, you must have. So they're your father's, right? So. This is Nazi saving, just Nazi saving. I'm going to put my mother in jail for my kid. It's still teaching. It's coming out suddenly. I'm thinking about it. Well, the ship was called. Sorry? Modern's outfitters, of course. It's all going to be. Okay, over the last year of the team. As I understood our meeting yesterday, we're edging towards a bridging gap. Country was, you might think, they're waging a major class struggle against the representatives of imperialism, particularly one woman. But we are reaching some sort of edging towards, right? Now, when we last met, Charlotte and myself, we understood that where we were going was a memorandum of understanding. Your brilliant idea, Advocate Jenkins, that what we would do is take Kusasa's proposals, expect from it most, if not all, that they wanted that the committee would agree with, and put it into an MOU. So it's got a legal meaning somewhere between a report to Parliament and the vote. But then after further discussion, it's been decided that we put it into the report rather. But I explained on behalf of the study group, because, you know, other times meet last night, that look, there has to be an amendment to the law. And it has to meet the requirements. And the minister, the DG, DVD acting DG, Kosatu, and the two chairs have been working on this since last night. And as I understand it, maybe we should start with Treasury. Maybe we start with the Jenkins, representing Parliament, then Treasury, then Kosatu, on where we are. And then take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The proposal that we want to bring to the committee to bridge this gap, as you say, is just to deal with the area of consultation leading up to the coming into effect of the provisions of amortization. You will remember what the committee did last year was after it said, well, the amortization will start 1 March 2016. Let's at least then have a review of those provisions, of the impact of those provisions within 2 years to see whether the fears of both labour and industry materialise or not. So the issue are a bit reverse now, seeing that we want to delay the coming into effect. So what we do is to change that clause that is in the 2050 Taxation Laws Amendment Act to say, instead of having a review of it, to have a consultative process prior to it with a specific date in which the Minister will then report to the National Assembly or Parliament, so that we as a committee then can have an oversight over the process prior to the amortization kicking in 2018. So I think we put an exact date there of August 2017 for the Minister to come and report. Also to get to the point of certainty which the industry is going to have, and thought we strike in balance with that the text of the proposed amendments there, I think it's on Chris's computer, I don't know if we can have it on a screen or something. If it's not possible, we need to try and put it up so that we can see what we're talking about. But we only finalize that just before we cancel the committee, so it's a short time to see your print. But the
content is...
Yes, we'll
a little bit around for a degree?
Jefferson, I'm sorry to say today. Remember last week, during our happiest year, when we had a serious moment in this one, for the national.
Yes.
And it's because of the conversation issue. When I've asked the question, I don't know if somehow the answer is here, okay, but I didn't hear you speaking about it. Because this is for what, this is the perception out there in the public, that there's no conversation. So if it comes to us as a quality, we leave it to treasure and then deal with it and not attending to it, it's going to give us problems. So I just wanted to know that to explain what is the understanding of conversation, what do they mean? Because it's also so there today, according to the conversation.
Yeah, I think our issue of conversation actually involves the entire process and also the complexity of the process. Because it's not very easy, it's not a simple bill to analyze and attach to. In fact, the consultation would involve a whole team beyond myself, people who are more skilled in return and fund issues. So it involves, at that discussion stage, obviously with the department, Treasury specifically, and obviously with relevant people in the industry, including obviously a principal at NAVLAC. Well, historically we were involved in CRUS through our representation in CRUSU, but we would insist that ourselves and obviously other partner unions have been consulted in a separate process because we represent too big a constituency to wait on abandonment. And we are making the process obviously for that consultation to happen, it doesn't have to happen at NAVLAC. And obviously we would, that consultation, any consultation that has been compromised from the department process, we feel has a spin-off effect in terms of parliamentary process because we're informed. The department comes here with its report in terms of consultation, and then obviously it's a more constrained process than a consultation around the table in terms of the Treasury process. So yes, we would look forward to other proposals in terms of, as you've indicated, we want to actually deal with that issue up here, as well as the instructions that are given to the executive. But yeah, we, our consultant information is that as well.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Professor. I think the matter of consultation, Honorable De Gladys is bringing it up for the second time. It's quite a serious matter, Chairperson. Can I make a request to you, Chair, to Nusa, that they actually write down the response so that it's detailed and then it's sent to the Chairperson in writing and then it can be given to us members. We do take note of the input which has been given now, but we need the detailed information on the matter in writing, on this matter of why there is a matter of consultation and exactly what do they mean on it. Thank you.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's two separate processes. the one is consultation with the executive, with the departments, and the other is with Parliament. On the Parliament side, we have also issued a statement. So, really, there's nothing for us to do beyond that. We can say, I'll be asked to send you a copy. On your problems with consultation with the executive national officials, you need to write to us. But on Parliament side, I don't know what we're supposed to do. We did exactly what we have to do.
Yeah.
And we should statement to that. I think from you, there wasn't there. Can you give us a copy to as well? Okay. Over to you then. Can you explain? I'm sorry, Advocate Jenkins. So there it is on the screen, right? Tell us very quickly.
Please. So the technical part of this is we have to look, of course, at the bill in front of us.
Cool.
The bill in front of us on page 7 has the clause field. That's the clause that we're dealing with.
Yes.
So just to focus members on that. And we want to now effect an amendment to that clause, which will have the effect of amending the 2015 Act.
Can we actually add it to clause 1, at the end of clause 1, I was imagining? Good.
What page is it? It's page, it's called what?
It's page 7, checklist, clause 3.
Ah, here we are.
I mean, the way we've worded it, I think at the moment it would go at the end of clause 1, if that's fine. But it's just the same.
But that's fine. So you look at, we're on the screen at the moment, you look at clause 3, subclause 1C. 1C says it deletes subsection 8 of section 3 of the 2015 Act.
So first of all, we propose to take that away.
Oh.
We're not going to just play delete it. We want to substitute it with a new clause. The new clause word is on the other one, if we can go to that. I think what the discussion between Christian is, where is the appropriate place to put this clause? That's a technical matter. We don't have to get too excited about that. But that is the wording of it. It says in A, first of all, there shall be deliberations with interested parties. And then B says what would those deliberations include. It's not a closed list. And it will be an EDLAC. But as I said, it's not a closed list for members. So it includes stakeholders outside EDLAC that wants to make separate submissions. And the minister needs to report that in terms of sub C by no later than 31 August 2017. So that would feed basically into the preparation for the budget for the next financial year when these compulsory retirement annuitization of provident funds would kick in, which should, according to my colleague's presentation, be sufficient time to deal with it. If it should be suspended, or if it should not be implemented, or if it should be implemented, are there specific conditions under which it should be implemented? That will, of course, depend on the deliberations from now until August 2017.
Right. Any comments, please?
So, Chair, this is obviously premised on the fact that because we also worked on the underlying, well, I don't want to call it an MOU because I think that the consensus is that there shouldn't be, well, certainly from the other side, not from Chair, we open to an MOU, but that the other parties may not want to sign into an MOU. What I understand they prefer is that it be put in the report. So it then explains the underlying timelines and so on and what we mean. I would really hope to let NUSA and other parties out of NADAC are also happy with this model. So basically what we say is that the social reform paper will be released by the end of June, roughly. Okay, that's what the executive commits to doing. That obviously it will include both the package of social security measures that government puts forward and the retirement reforms. And of course it will include issues that the committee raised like the annuitization and of preservation. That we're hoping that we don't see one agreement coming out of NADLAC or any of these processes, that some things will be more urgent than others, like the retirement reforms, and that the first report on the consultation come out sometime end of December, but we say 15th December, because we don't work after the 15th, from the 1st or 2nd of January. So that at least the first report is available from NADLAC on progress made. That, by the way, would help because it could also be incorporated into the budget for next year. So if we have a first deadline like that would help. Then there will be a second deadline, which would be the end of June or the middle of June next year. That would lay the basis for putting things into legislation to the extent that there's agreement. It's still in time for the tax legislation to the extent that tax legislation is involved and non-tax legislation. And lays the basis for point C, that the minister can then has time to report to the assembly on the 31st of August. So that's based on these two reports. We felt that there should be at least a month or two for the minister then to provide any further details. So that is the underlying agreement that we, or certainly the commitment that Treasury would be very comfortable with making in this process. I don't know if Olano or Chris want to add on the process. Chair, of course, the points that are made as well as discussed with you is we do make clear that if annuitization is kept for provident funds, then obviously the tax deductions would cease. So it's in all our interest to get an agreement, because and although that's not in the legislation like this, that we don't want there to be any expectations that the tax deduction on contributions will continue. And if it don't regard,
I'll get that in the report.
Yeah, so that will be in the report, yeah.
Okay, Mackie?
Yeah, no, thanks so much, Chair. Yeah, look, I think there's been good thoughts from the engagements we had after the committee meeting yesterday with Rebecca Jenkins, former on the team, and I think also yourself telephonically. I think from our side, we just basically are working towards two things. One is to an amendment to the bill, which kind of requires consultation with stakeholders. And I think then for us, the flesh will come out in the parliamentary report, the inner details. I think we're fairly comfortable with the wording. We found the wording in the previous act, which provided for consultation with stakeholders. I think we're also happy to see NEDLAC also included there as well. I think it could help us from the chair to have a bit of assurance for the engagements going forward.
I lost you. You're laughing.
Right. So I think for us, what's useful about the amendment bill is that it provides a legal assurance for engagement going forward. Yeah. So it's in that law. And it's clear to all parties, even at least with a bit of certainty and clarity. And I think it also helps us to kind of flesh out the conditional deferment, so to speak. I think we would rather go for the second part of it, the parliamentary report, as opposed to MOU. MOU would obviously have the unintended consequence of excluding non-signatory, so to speak.
I hope somebody's listening. It probably takes into other benefits.
I kind of the prodigal child, the prodigal sister. yeah, no, and I think that all the costs of the MOU can be captured in the parliamentary report in terms of the tablings, the time frames, the report, consultations, parameters, etc. I'll just give a final kind of go-ahead and a final reading from our NOBs today, but I'm sure can get that. I think she also plea from our NOBs as well, also that we, even though it's an additional amendment to the bill, but we still work all out to pass it by next week. And it also helps all parties have a bit of certainty, delay, fears, etc. Then I think lastly, Comrade Chair, that maybe just to reassure our prodigal sister that membership, this is a quick calculation now, our membership of SATU is 50-50 in terms of the public sector and in terms of private sector. So just to address that miss. Thanks so much.
Is it 50-50
really? Yeah.
I thought it's 70-30.
According to the last CEC report, it's about 928 public service, 931.
Oh, really?
The industrial sector.
This is not audited. We can have them find out. All right, Atisha?
Chair, it's looking very promising from our point of view, but we too are a mandated organisation, so I would need to get a mandate from members, but I'm able to do that very quickly. We like the idea of the, we certainly like the idea of the a parliamentary report, and I do like the lines of the sand, the dates. I think that is the certainty, because the big, big concern is, as I have expressed, is that we do not remain in uncertainty because potentially consultation processes are not going the way they should be going, and in 2 years' time we have a mad scramble at the end and possible repeat of this. At all costs,
we're going to put it in our report. Actually, I'm very clear, advocate, you're working on a draft, right?
Yes.
I should like it by 5 years or later, and then I'll work on it to put very stringent measures of checking on progress. Even though you've got your December 15 deadline and so on, you have to see how you're doing that. Because we'll get the first reward within 3 months. And I'll invite us to as well. So basically you're fine. That's why in the circumstances, you're not happy, but you deliver this. And you're also
this,
satisfied
with even the exact thing. Yeah, this is looking very encouraging. I'm sure the seat members will be encouraged by this.
Yes. All right. Now, I take it then that you will find consulting next Congress. Remember, it's in your interest, right? Because this trade union federation, the one that constantly postpones to be formed, this never-ending postponement of the federation, will be very important. You need to be close to Kosovo. Find them to be strong. to defeat. He was divided rules. That's how cancer stuff works.
You heard me?
You
heard
me?
Hey, Linda, nothing that's said outside of this mic, you can quote. And not everything said on this mic can be quoted either. In your absence, we ban you from these meetings, right? Because I say very profound things. Like this, I was talking about my mother not allowing me to buy a bat. You don't put that in the news, right? I talk about... Yeah. I'm older. To Dodgery, that's not... Chairperson admit he's older than Dodgery. Instead, you focus on that matter, right? But on a more serious note, I have put some records in there that I actually said that. And Ada looked at the light to quote, and I wouldn't quote it out of context, so I can't even use that line. However, on reflection, I think that...
that was a very accurate comment. I mean, they are roads in criminals.
Yes, yes, I know, but you see, you are there where you are, and I am where I am. And I actually think it is not consistent with the view of the majority in this committee, not least my own party.
The minister said, finally, in the budget speech,
the yes, Linda, but I would like to just, for what it's like, if you after this meeting, I just want to say, in your absence, I did explain that statement was said, I wasn't saying another context, it's not right of Linda is for anybody to quote me on that. I do regret that you don't quote me on my lovely anecdotes, but that's another story I have to describe. But I do feel, on reflection, it was somewhat in the coalition to always focus on that actually, as a committee, and myself too, personally, I feel that we should encourage people to pay up, you know, to disclose and pay. The point I look to make is not linked on the generosity of their hearts or a sudden surge of patriotic fervor. They do it because they're vulnerable. And we must encourage them. So I'll write a letter to the end of the page. I was quoted correctly. And then that's my buddy. And I'll mention the anecdotes you should have quoted. And then say, look, I have reflection to feel that it was, I find right, well, what's for you be the right, but in the course, to say it like that, without stressing that it's my own view and the view of the ANC and the committee as a whole, that we should encourage people. You just said that people would not sit up in jail and so on, as I did, try to encourage people to actually come forward. Wow, Linda. You should join us, Linda. Yes.
Chairperson, I think the conversation which you're having with Linda, now it's not on the agenda, please you can talk to her.
I would like to request,
I noted that Linda is from Business Day, so we will be watching what you have written about this because public information is not in public, so we'll be watching Linda.
No, you are under surveillance.
Yeah, we'll be watching.
Even for the IFP. Yeah, but thank you all, the process now is this. Please remember, and now the DA is going to go to the Constitutional Court about this, I know that. We are, what we are doing is, can we please hear, because we need quorum, Pinky Makosi. I don't run on for quorum tomorrow.
What?
Quorum tomorrow. I will try to finish the report tonight and send it to all members by Alan, right, by 10 o'clock tonight. The amendments will be given to you as well to look at the Kachenkins by that time. Then what we're going to do is meet at what about the first 10 minutes in the House of Members' questions? Why can't we meet at 10, at 2 o'clock in G26, Alan?
When?
Tomorrow. 2 o'clock, and we finish at 10 part 2. Okay. Oh, yeah?
Jim, there's no way to agree to that, I'm afraid. It's just not on. I do want to propose some amendments as well. So, there's no way we're going to have a 10-minute meeting.
All right, let me get a meeting
and
longer.
Chairman, we're not doing the plenary.
What do
you question time. We will be in plenary.
All right, that's fine. We'll check the rules. Advocate, we can still go ahead and meet. We'll get before 2 o'clock. What time do you meet at 1:30?
Chairman, I already have an engagement immediately after caucus through 2 o'clock. I'm afraid I am not available, and I don't think that my colleague will be available either. I don't know. I also wish to ask where we're going with this amendment. It's quite a significant amendment that's being proposed. What about public hearings? There are many role players who are not here, who have no idea about this amendment, who have not been given the opportunity to come and address us on the amendment. Surely there should be further public hearings?
No. We do what we do in this parliament. We had public hearings, advertise for. You wrote to all the stakeholders. How do you know about that? You know we did all this. We reported to you. Now, we don't have public hearings again if you've made an amendment to a bill that you actually advertise for public hearings for. We, in fact, went out of our way. We wrote to, even which is not an obligation, wrote to people who came in October last year. And, Jenkins, we have to have another public hearing, sir.
Mr. Chairman, let me just come in here.
Yeah.
You see, this is not an amendment that has kind of come out of this committee. This is an amendment that's come out of negotiations with a particular role player in this game. Even a CISO wasn't involved yesterday. So you've got an amendment now coming, basically a Cassatio-driven amendment. That's what it is. To be clear, that is what it is. And so we are allowing as a committee Cassatio to drive an amendment, and we are ignoring the other role players in the industry. And that, I'm afraid, from our point of view, is just not the right thing to be doing. Now, it may be legal, it might not be required. I have to accept that I'm certainly no expert to that. But ethically, we can't see that this is the right thing to do. And so that's why we're raising that. And then, indeed, we've got our own amendments, which we want to place for the committee, whenever the appropriate time comes.
No, we table it now. We're discussing it. We don't agree. You don't like it, you're going to vote against the bill. But if you've got your amendments, here we are. We've got at least an hour and 15 minutes. Can you table it?
Yeah.
We discussed the whole thing. We put the issue before you. It's an utterly absurd set of things to say. Never before in the entire... It's utterly absurd.
Mr. Chairman,
it's not absurd. It was a public hearing.
Yeah.
When we have
it might be your opinion that it's
absurd. It's a legal fact. We've never done it. We have never had hearings after we've had hearings. We've just made an amendment. Furthermore, you have every right between now and 1 o'clock, and more if you want to propose your amendments. Where are they? No one's stopping you from doing so. We have many times met a single stakeholder, a season of house invited, were you not there yesterday, Rose? We made it a little bit. Were you not there yesterday? Where? At the meeting yesterday? You gave out a written submission, yes?
Yes, I was at yesterday morning's meeting.
Yes.
But the negotiations afterwards, those discussions, I think, is
what the... Yeah, but that's the outcome. You agree with the outcome, aren't you?
I'm saying that I haven't had a chance to consult with our members, but it looks encouraging.
So do you want more time? You've got more time, because we've got up till... You can come back to me, but you'll have another meeting now. Can I have a meeting? Okay, so can we have a meeting? I will have a meeting now at the CISA, COSATU, you can join the meeting, and the chair. You want to join the meeting else?
Yeah,
meeting?
I can.
Right. So what are your amendments? Who's stopping you from proposing your amendments?
No one's stopping you. So we haven't yet got to the point where we're discussing a bill. We're talking about amendments to the bill proposed and coming out of Cassatio. We will now put our amendments.
So please, let's say.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is really, as I said already, a product of certain behind-the-scenes negotiations with a particular officer. Most of the public concerns, as has been expressed this morning by me, about the annuitization of benefits payable on retirement are misinformed. Annuitization already applies to pension funds and retirement annuities. And you've just told this committee how you spent 45 minutes, I think it was, talking to a teacher in my hometown about that very fact. The Revenue Laws Amendment Bill will not change that. The government employees pension fund members are not affected by the 2015 Tax Laws Amendment Act. The 2015 Tax Laws Amendment Act brought provident funds in line with pension funds. If the wish is for provident funds not to be in line with pension funds, then it's a question of a tax issue. That's what it's about. And so to suggest that this is not a tax issue is not, in our opinion, the correct view. So if you were to have the requirement to annuitize removed, even if it is for 2 years, then the tax issue must also be in it. You can't have it both ways. all contributors to retirement funds and provident funds may withdraw the entire amount due to them at any time prior to the retirement date. It is a myth that they can't do that. There must be tax implications, and that is a decision that the individual would have to make. Provident fund members, in terms of their vested, are not affected by the changes already made to the Act. So no one is being prejudiced about that. Mr. Chairman, the purpose, stated purpose of postponing the requirement to purchase an annuity for provident fund members for 2 years is to allow for more consultation. Now, the amendment that is proposed does not require a particular output. It simply requires that consultation take place and reports come back. Cosato made their position and NOMSA this morning quite clear. Cosato stated, and I quote, Cosato's position was and remains adamant that compulsory annuitization must be removed from the Act and the amendment bill. Cosato remains deeply averse to compulsory annuitization. NOMSA have expressed the same view. It is clear, therefore, that the postponement by 2 years is not supported in terms of the compulsory annuitization. Our view is that we won't die in a ditch for compulsory annuitization, but then the tax rate must not go to provident funds. Can't have them both ways. One of the most important issues faced in South Africa today is policy uncertainty. And this is a microcosm of that policy uncertainty. We're now going to put this industry back into uncertainty for the next 2 years. It's symptomatic of the way we're doing business in South Africa today. We've had a lot to say about savings this morning, Mr. Chairman. Gross savings in the third quarter of 2015 amounted to 15.2% of GDP. But the household savings were only 0.2% of GDP. The fourth quarter, they have not dropped to 0.1% of GDP. This has dire consequences for poverty in old age. This, in turn, makes the elderly who are affected with poverty at a time when they should be entitled to a secure retirement very vulnerable to being exploited. Very vulnerable. National Treasury has emphasized that, and we agree. The Comprehensive Social Security Forum paper has been in abeyance for 10 years or more and must be progressed as swiftly as possible because it in itself leads to policy uncertainty. This reform, and I think Momo echoes what I'm about to say, will not be a single event. It will take a considerable amount of time to be drafted, and implementation will of necessity be piecemeal. The changes to the annuitization of provident fund benefits now enacted in the 2015 PLAA have started this process towards a comprehensive social reform and must not now be reversed. Mr. Chairman, we propose amendment to the bill as it stands. Without that amendment, as it stands, that the clauses 1, 3, 4, and 5 be deleted, and the one clause remain, which is a technical amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, responses, please. Please do a reply.
Chair, if I may, for a moment. Chair, so I think we sort of understand the concern around providing the tax benefit to Provident Fund members, whereas postponing the annuitization for the next 2 years. Chair, we are trying to manage various interests and challenges there.
if you take away both the benefit and the requirement to annuitize, effectively means you are carving out provident funds. Effectively means for the industry, you will have to undo a significant portion of the upgrades you've done. And this is an issue we have tried to manage with the industry in terms of how can we make it less painful in terms of the changes we are proposing, in the sense that they don't have to go back and undo a lot of the systems they have done. So the two-year postponement just on the annuitization is based on the realization that if it's just only on annuitization, then the system can be able to manage that postponement. You don't necessarily need to undo a lot of the upgrades you have done. But yes, the principle remains that in the absence of annuitizing, it becomes difficult to justify in the long term a tax benefit.
Yeah, the problem we face, and if you go back to the media release that we put out, I think it was October 27th, if you remember, we were offering two options. The one was to implement the reforms as we have it in the Act, and the other was a phased approach towards annuitization. And you'll note in that that I think this, I don't have it in front of me, but we recognize that the way we've changed the law, before there was an employer contribution and an employee contribution. The employer contribution was not taxable, so it was a non-taxable fringe benefit. So what it means is that Provident Fund members have been getting a tax deduction for the employer contribution. That is why when we say at the high end there was abuse, that people who want to structure, would structure all their contribution towards their retirement into a Provident Fund and make the employer be seen to be making the contribution. It's only where an employee makes his or her own contribution, and you'll find that with many workers, there's a case where the employer puts in 50 and they put in 50%. It may vary in percentage. Some will have maybe 100% or zero or whatever. But the employee contribution does not enjoy the tax deduction. So that's why when we looked at the phased approach, we said we've got to cap the deduction at this, what was it? 15 or...
Yeah, so we say 15, we had a bunch of
15, and then going to gradually zero, okay? If there was no annuitization, if I remember. Just remind me.
Yeah, I think we kept it at 10. I don't think we were taking it away. Obviously.
Yes. So I think that there are issues there like that that will come up. So what I'm saying is, in effect, if there's no tax deduction, which from a principal's perspective certainly would be the logical way to go in the long term. But if you were to do that immediately, members of Provident Funds would actually take home significantly less, because the employer contribution would then not enjoy a tax deduction. So I'm just making aware of the implications.
Yeah,
that's why if you go to the October statement, it kind of had a phased approach, because we thought it's unfair to remove it immediately.
Okay, can I do a few things? I'm quite taken aback by this. Firstly, I don't understand what you're saying. Ever since 1998, the committee that I've chaired, sort of the legislative bloc, in case of local government and justice, we sat till 11 at night. We were exempted for the House. On this particular bill, the House chair from the NCOP side and the speaker from the National Assembly side had said to us that when it comes to finance, we've got a blank check. I think probably justice was the game to the bill. So you yourself said in subcommittee while the House was sitting last year, Dears Van Rooy and Jaded, G26. Last week, Thursday, we had public hearings. While the plenary was meant to sit, the decision to call off the plenary was made on Wednesday. Besides that, nobody from the DA objected. But previous week, we sought an extension of an hour. Prime Minister Gordhan spoke to us, both houses, were present at committees. So this committee will never be able to do its work were we to sit on the sitting, normal sitting time. So it's something new now that, no, when the plenary is sitting, we're not coming to committee meeting. Okay, can I open up? Are you at your hands? If that's what you're saying, then it's fine. Okay, that's fine. Okay, fine. So then the second thing is we've had a subcommittee system. Nothing stopped you from coming to these meetings. It's just boring, actually. You are welcome to come. Now, FISA, we would give you a meeting. So after this meeting, you come and say things that you feel you can't say in the public domain. We have a meeting. You should have said to me. You know, you must ask yourself, can you Google this? There is no country in the world that I know, and addressing both of you, both clearly, where a committee in Parliament sits till the day before we vote on a bill and give you a chance. We ask them, give us inviting. After the last week's public hearing, we then turn to you and say, if there's something between complete expansion and deferment, you leave it to us. I read the document. We table the document. You won't get that chance anyway. You are not an ally.
Only in Mongolia.
Only in Mongolia. You're not an ally of this ANC alliance. They are. But you have the same rights as David. The reason we brought them in, right, is to actually knock them down. They haven't got what they wanted, fully. They actually wanted an expansion like Nusa. So this is not a facade to build in that sense. They didn't get complete expansion. Right? So, since you feel very aggrieved, which you should have raised with me, I'm stunned, Rosemary, that you didn't say, hey, Eunice, I want to be there too. So you want to come, we're going to cover the same ground again that we covered yesterday. So, I remember, Charlie's not here. I will repeat everything we said. There was no conspiracy. Right? So, we have done this many times. I have sat with your constituency, South African Agricultural Union, on the property rates bill, right?
Not my constituency.
You have a DA constituency, you know. You're told here, I'm even said to your member, how come this Communist Party leader of the ANC, the committee, is giving it agriculture? Look at Business Day, page 3, 10 years ago, right? Praising me for agreeing on the price. She won't be happy about that, right? She was insulted at the time. So, why must we do it for the South African Agricultural Union on property rates bill? Why must we do it for TAU on the property rates bill? Why must we do it for the private sector on the municipal systems bill, but we can't do it for COFATU? What's so special about all these other... So we will continue to do it, Jenkins. You show me where in the world it's wrong to take a specific course and say, knock your head together. So we'll continue to do it until you show it's unconstitutional. That is the way public participation should be. Right? So now that you are apparently via him for bidding, could you speak on your behalf? So let's have a meeting. After the speech, I'm ready to sit with
you. If I could just make a perception, Mr. Lees is certainly, I'm not speaking to Mr. Lees. I'm not aggrieved. We understand that there is an alliance, a political alliance, and we respect that. We understand that. I did not mean or have any intention to gatecrash any meeting yesterday afternoon.
You could have come.
Had I been invited, I would have attended, but I respect the alliance. I respect that.
Yeah.
But I'm not agreed.
Okay, you're not speaking for
us. Mr. Chairman?
And again, you know, Chairman, you are very successfully twisting what I said. And I'm aggrieved. I do not in any way suggest that a CISA were aggrieved.
Mr. Chairman, I simply said
that the amendment on the board was a product of negotiations between COFATU and National Treasury and some others.
So which
and the point I'm making,
Mr. Chairman,
do you really want me in this meeting or don't you? Because if you don't, then say so.
I'm not going to argue the question.
I've got the form, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the question, the point I put was that, and again you twisted my words, I did not say at any stage that COFATU should not be consulted with. Not once. I simply said that there are players in this game who came to the public hearings and who haven't been given the opportunity to comment. And whether we should or shouldn't or legally need to, I actually said to you, Mr. Chairman, I actually said to you that I had no idea whether it was legally a requirement or not, but ethically I thought we should. So, Mr. Chairman, you twist my words terribly, 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 and I object to that. I really do object to that.
Can you explain something simply? Which section of industry has been excluded? And who should be cut out? Which?
Mr. Chairman, all right, let's go through them. BG Vermicil firm. Who was that? Andrew Crawford. And possibly others that who were here. Who were
yes, they didn't ask for verbal.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I answered your question, and that's all I'm suggesting.
The does not.
I'm not suggesting that we have to do it.
I'm just saying
that
we have made their submissions, right? And there's no requirement on us to contact them, come again for public hearings. There's no such thing. It's never been done in this parliament. We go far beyond what's required of us, and we can't do more. So we've read their submissions. I read their submissions. What more do you want me to do? There's nothing there, to the fund looked at them, that's particularly distinctly different from the discourse we've had. So I don't think you should misrepresent what has been happening. And nobody seems deliberately. Now I see what you're talking about. So presumably you mean the people in the written submission. You've been in Parliament long enough.
Well,
they never spoke. Did you stop anybody from... We didn't get any requests for them to speak. They simply wrote to us.
I seem to remember people speaking at our public hearings.
No. On this one, actually, everybody was written to. Some of them said they don't want to appear before the committee, but they will write to us. They might have come to observe. But hey, there is no requirement. So that you're just wrong if you suggest that, if you suggest that. But he said, you want to have a meeting and cover the ground and report to you. Because every subcommittee, when it only was passed to all the other parties, we have to report. We can't take any decisions. It just saves a lot of time. Now, from now on, I think you should come to every meeting. If you want to spend the time, I don't think others want to, you come to every meeting. It's fine.
I can't be at every meeting.
Right. So then, can we just raise something else? That actually, on clause 1, 3, 4, and 5, the effect of what you say has been covered in many, many ways from the beginning of the public hearings on this matter. I would like members to respond to the DA's proposals and amendments to the bill. Can you reply to that, please?
So are we not agreeing with
what emerged earlier? Are we saying we want to do what the DA says?
Sir, I had thought we were finding each other, and I thought we should go ahead with yesterday's engagement and what has been brought to us here as a committee as sort of an outcome that tried to harmonize the challenges that were picked up when we did the last amendment. And from what Advocate Jenkins was saying, I think we should go with what the Advocate is saying as well.
Well, it's basically the compromise that emerged between Treasury and the Union's beliefs, at least one section, one federation, and as guided by the committee, based on inputs occurred here, is what we're going for, so we're saying no. So if you look at the specific clauses, we'll take a few minutes. Advocate Jenkins has gone through, we've discussed it. So strictly speaking, we don't need more than 10 or 15 minutes. We say no to the proposal from the DA. That's what I understand. So now formally, just let me take Happy Jenkins, now formally what happens is that tomorrow we vote on the bill. Must we actually get a written thing from the clause 1, 3, 4, and 5 to be deleted and so on? Or do they, it's just done verbally? It's covered now. As far as I know, it's covered now and done with it. Before we just, let the court speak, please.
No, Chair, I just wanted you to stress the point that the intention of the committee is to, as much as possible, harmonize the relationships between amongst the stakeholders, which is labor, business, and government. And I honestly don't think it was anything wrong with having extended meetings with any partner who is saying, I would like more space, and I would like to make my input, and I would like to be heard. And I do think that we have to make it clear that any other stakeholder who is in one who wants to make an input is most welcome and should, in spite of these issues,
because they actually, they have very bad signals about who we are and what we are doing. I think in as much as possible, I think we need to avoid that. And I don't really see anything wrong. I do think that if Musa had indicated to you that they wanted to make a submission and they probably need a meeting with you, Jefferson, I honestly do not think that she would have stopped and
stopped. Not only that, he's done it with the Austrian Bible. Yeah. The investor came to see me. Right?
And it's been a long process with the one I reported on you. And African
you do it all the time.
Yes.
Yes, I report to him and I say, look, there's a meeting, this is what happened. But the stakeholder came to me and I said, no, you've got such a vested interest in this Bible, right? It is better, and you're too technical for me. I'm a politician. Come and explain. Come in the public hearing. So that's what they did. It happens all the time. Actually, I mean, but also I hardly talk to you guys. I talk to you about politics. Maybe you're one of the least I've engaged with, actually. Controlling fires to sit for hours, and so on. So we will continue to do what Parliament requires of an active, public participation sensitive chair. And it's not a change. So being credited, I'm being lambasted here. You go and look up, Google it, see where you'll ever get opportunity you have. So would you, because we wanted the same opportunity. But I'm very happy to speak to you and summarize for you. We summarize it here, but I can teach the whole thing. What he said was no secret.
Mr. Chair, I have no issue whatsoever. I'm actually quite stressed that you have the perception that I'm unhappy about any of the proceedings. I'm not unhappy. I was very comfortable.
No, it's clarified now. You're not talking about you.
Yeah.
You're talking about Holland and we looked at all that stuff.
And Mr. Chair, the report back that we received this morning to the procedure and what the outcome of your meetings was satisfactory. I have no issue with the
chair. And I also put
you. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I've had my... I also put here, yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
Mr. Chair,
and she shared her hand up. She had her hand up. Okay, fine, having said that, you got something to say, sorry. Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you see, once again, what I said has been completely misconstrued. I don't know whether it's deliberate or not.
I can't
look at your head. But the fact is that I have said that consultation with Kazashu at no stage did I say that that was inappropriate. At no stage did I say it was inappropriate. All I suggested and asked was it appropriate for us to call on others to consult with them. I didn't know whether it was legally possible, but I thought ethically it might be needed. You pointed out to me that, in fact, they haven't asked you to do it. Well, that might be a good enough reason. But for the record, there is no opposition to consulting with anyone in this meeting, outside the meeting, wherever it happens. If it's going to help the process, 100%. 100%. And please, let that now be the record. And put members of the committee whom we have a long working relationship ahead of us. Please understand that I never said that and never implied that. In fact, I think I'm going to listen to the PNG record just to make sure that I didn't say something I didn't intend to say.
All right, let's move on. Can I just raise this issue now? Because we have to vote on this. So the options are we would prefer more than one party to be voting there, even if they come to say they're opposed. So if there's no agreement that we meet tomorrow, we'll have to meet on Friday at 10 o'clock because we have to vote on this vote this week. So I would like to engage outside this meeting with the opposition party to find a suitable time because it's the House that will be able to debate these things. The parties that are opposing will oppose it anyway. So I'm suggesting that if we can't get agreement on meeting tomorrow, I'll seek to ensure that we meet on Friday at 10 o'clock to vote on the vote. And I really regret that people's constituents and other work will be impeded, but what can we do? Right, over to you, Al.
Mr. Chairman, I just need to put the record straight again. At no stage did I say that meeting during the plenary was unacceptable. I simply said tomorrow is President's questions, and I didn't know whether I could make it or not. And certainly before that, I have an engagement. I mean, there's a long-standing engagement, and if you really want to know...
You're not opposed in principle.
Absolutely
not. In which case... we can try to meet just after 12 o'clock. I'll discuss after the meeting. It depends on when the caucus is finished, because I don't think caucus gives people doesn't allow people to leave before the caucus is sitting. So can we talk for a few minutes after this meeting, and we'll set the time and Helen will send the notes. Good, thank you very much. Anybody else from you?
Just as an ESA, I do agree. I think that is the best way we can try and set up a guide. As you stated, just at the same time we say on the top. But Chairperson Kate, can you just take us back just a little bit? Out of the list, Chairperson, of people that get submissions, we are aware that there are certain people who may say to you they would like to make written submissions. And I think probably that is the list which my colleague here has got. But then, Chairperson, let's open up again, you know, other people as well who may want to come in. But I think most of what we will see from Chairperson are people that say they would just like to make oral submissions so that we get an understanding of who actually said they need to make oral submissions, and then probably make time for more people to consult with. But definitely we can meet after this meeting to set up a time when we can discuss, as you have stated. Thank you.
I'm just saying that we had the hearings. The written submissions were read, presumably all of us, I certainly read them. We asked Gilasani to read them and pick up whether there are any things in any of these submissions that are not covered by the discussions we've had. It will not be possible to have public hearings again tomorrow, so there's nothing more we can do. I know that the NCOP spoke about possibly having public hearings on that side. I don't know if it's still going on. Are they having public hearings? We're not sure. But the NCOP is sitting there, and the people can request to go to the NCOP side and make representations if they want. But I imagine that the people who really want to make oral submissions were the ones that appeared for the committee last week. Momo?
Sorry, I know this is not about business, but I was just going to ask, is it possible to go through, even if you don't finalize the bill, the clause by clause, because in a sense, if there are issues, we'd just like to know.
Okay, yeah, fine. We can do that quickly. I will do this tomorrow, but you're right. In case something comes up at the last moment. As I remember, we were taken through the bill, right? At that stage, we had asked Advocate Jenkins, because the bill only has one issue. The rest of it is purely technical. So it's not like going to the Financial Sector Regulation Bill or the African Crime Bill. So I thought we'd just do it straightforward. But you're right, there may be things. So we're looking at clause one, we're taking it informally. Is there anything beyond what Advocate Jenkins said last time you want to say this time?
Not sure.
Oh, right. So on clause one, is there anything you want to pick up? Want to make a change there?
No, no. I just want Chris to come in, so the other clause that we want, so you know exactly what it's going to be effective.
Well, we'd like to send the text out by this evening, please. So the members look at it before they come to the committee tomorrow.
It was due to within an hour.
Yeah, I would
have it now.
Yeah, okay, fine, then we can give it to Alan to send out now. The report I'll have to look at all tonight.
Yes, shall I?
Yeah.
So, the clause one. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, listen. The clause one is the provision for annuitization, which I'll postpone. We went through in the previous public hearing that it's all been replaced, and we needed to do that to replace the date in line 44, 47, etc. The change to the bill, the proposed change to the bill, was that the first clause deals with all the annuitization for the different retirement funds, and the Advocate Jenkins, this is, can you just check this with me? But we were thinking of, if you look at the bill, is number 2 here, subsection 1, contingent operational 1, 2018, and then we would from there have a 3. And 3 would refer to the wording we said, so that the Minister of Finance will deliberate with interested parties in respect of the manner of implementation of subsection 1. So subsection 1 would be part of clause 1 and would be the annuitization referring to that, if that is okay with the committee. And then, again, the deliberation contemplated in A to include deliberations at NEDLAC. And the
you want to cover this, but we've covered
it. Yeah, so we've covered that. So, I don't know if any other questions on one. We can move on.
So, the only amendment we're going to have is
okay, right. Is anybody who doesn't understand that? No, okay. Right. Then the next one, please.
Okay, so close to, as previously mentioned, was this technical error with the deduction. Okay, that's fine. And clause 3 was on the deletion of the previous annuitization requirement and the postponement of all the other sections related to transfers, compulsory annuities, etc. And so Advocate Jenkins, I think we were now, because initially we were trying to replace C, but now by putting the provision into when we can actually keep C, then we would still delete the 2-year review. Okay. So that's fine on clause 3. On clause 4, this is in relation to transfers again, so it's a postponement of the transfers. And on clause 5, 113, I think this is also part of transfers. Again, it's just a delay. Yeah, it's just a delay to those at the moment. So the other clauses are all just with delays. So they are as
you okay. Here. On the last 3, 4, 5, any comments? No. Good. So basically, informally, we process the book. So it's all tomorrow. But I really would urge members to please check, right? Because it could be a big set of changes. So can you send us out by 2 p.m. 6? What's the time now? 12:35. So you do it at 2. Yeah, it's done, yeah. So can you send it out by this afternoon, 3 o'clock, very late, right?
Okay.
And the report, I'll send it out to you guys. Yeah, okay, 3 p.m. is the cutoff, preferably. Or 2 after that. Thank you very much. Is there anything else? No. Can I just speak to Paul Eli and ask when we can agree on the time?
So what we're going to have to do, just to be clear,
yeah.
We have to conform to section 11.5 of the Pythagoras. So,
and the normal procedure in the system.
Some of those 5 factors.
Yeah, we'll bring that in.
So we'll have to bring all of those reports when you
that's
finally
right.
Consider
yeah. Them. Yeah, but what we would like is for you to get that available as soon as possible.
Yeah, that will take us, we will try and do it before 5 today.
Yeah. Because it's not that comprehensive.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I don't have to do this every now and then because every time you change the thing, that's okay.
Yeah.
Let's follow the right to so just abide by the rule. Thanks. Okay, fine.
I'll be